Hello, welcome to episode 45 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, which features Chris Ince, who's University Secretary and Chief Compliance Officer at the University of Hull. We discuss this distinctive title and the particular role Chris plays, which does have real logic to it given the way the external regulatory environment has grown and the extended responsibilities of governing bodies in England under the Office for Students. Chris has had an interesting career journey, from sabbatical officer at Imperial College to computer game tester before heading back to Imperial for his first administrative role, and then moving on to Kingston and SOAS before joining London Met and then Hull. Hull is, we agree, a great place with a long and proud history, but with something of a locational challenge in terms of student recruitment. However, those who do make it to the end of the train line, both students and staff, really do love the place. This passion is also expressed through the university's commitment to its vital role in the city and region, where it plays an anchoring position, including in relation to the green agenda locally and as it moves itself towards net zero. We also note the significant financial challenges ahead, both in terms of the cost of living and energy crisis, which will have a major impact on students and staff. Finally, we explore a couple of unusual aspects of higher education Chris has identified, including his surprise at the reluctance of some students to accept rational arguments over principles and the occasional difficulties of some in our institutions to absorb relevant ideas and practices from other sectors. I do hope you enjoy it.
Right, well, welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time, it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Chris Ince. Chris is University Secretary and Chief Compliance Officer at the University of Hull. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Paul. Nice to speak with you.
Great to speak to you. Well, let's pause first on your title, because it is, yeah, I think, undoubtedly a unique title in the sector. So how did you end up with that title, and what does it actually cover?
So it was a new title for the job when I started at Hull. So they'd previously had more of a traditional registrar and secretary role, but that had kind of been divided over time into chief operating officer and then my role, university secretary and chief compliance officer. Since then, we've also acquired, and it's a slightly more almost kind of corporate structure in some ways in terms of job title story. So we also have a CFO, so chief finance officer, and a chief people officer. We haven't gone the full suite and got a CIO in, but we've got people who effectively do that role. So yeah, it's a bit of a strange one. It's quite a narrow, I think, in terms of that kind of full spectrum of what a traditional registrar role is. So most of my function is in that governance and compliance space. So it's a number of small teams doing kind of corporate governance, information compliance, health and safety, but then also that kind of overarching compliance piece. So there are various areas that many of us in similar roles would have where we are accountable. And so my name is on the line, in some cases personally rather than institutionally, it turns out, for a variety of functions. But for example, people doing work around student visas are in the registry team, which is managed under the chief operating officer. My name is on the line with ASPL for people doing animal research. So all those kind of things, my name's there. And as I said, some of those are personal. So they've divided the role up a bit more, I think, as part of kind of, you know, the continual refresh we all do of structures and processes and systems. And I was working in London at the time, and we talk a bit more about it in a minute. So all my roles prior to this had been in London, and it was partly, it was during the middle of COVID. I was looking around, looking for other things to do, and this came up. And I think partly the opportunity, we talk more about Hull itself, but it was very much a step for me to try something outside of London, which was partly why Hull, and Hull was very attractive, traditional campus university in many ways compared to London, where even the campus universities aren't campus universities as yours is, for example. So that was partly that. It kind of makes a bit more sense as a job title when you talk to people outside of the sector, I think, because they do have quite senior compliance roles in quite a lot of firms. And I do get hit by a lot of, I was going to say spam, but that sounds very negative about some of them, but people from outside the sector trying to approach you about systems or processes or jobs, or come and talk at our convention. And you look at it and you think, I can kind of see why from the job title you think I might be relevant, but no, I'm not going to come out and hang out with your risk managers from your financial services sector today. Thank you very much.
But there, I think there is, although the title is unusual in the sector, I think there's a real logic to it. And, you know, there's a sense in which all of us who've been working in the kind of secretary registrar space over many years, actually have had an element of that role within our jobs. And I think the reality is it has grown and grown and grown over the years. And you're simply the first one to have it recognized, that central core aspect of our roles in your job title as well, and for it to be absolutely explicit.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think I've seen it a couple of other places in one way or another, but not necessarily quite the same, perhaps. But you're right, as you know, whether it's through the OFS and its approach and government, and you talk about where that's come from and going to, but also as we as a sector, both, I mean, we've probably always been doing it, but kind of start the interfaces with others. So, you know, when you start dealing with Ofsted more than perhaps you might have expected to or even wanted to, and all these other kind of bodies, there is a huge amount of regulation that becomes more and more challenging and perhaps even burdensome for us. So there is a need, as I said, you know, it starts, I'm not doing all of it, but you need some focus point to try and make sure things are happening. But also, and again, I don't know, you can talk about your own, is there are often, you suddenly find these gaps where so everybody thought somebody else was doing it, but nobody was. And part of my role centrally is to try and look for those over time.
I absolutely get that. And I think that has grown in importance. And because of the changing nature of the particularly for us in England, the Office for Students regime, the greater expectations placed on university governing bodies to seek assurance that these things are being addressed within university management structures means that we have to be much more confident that, you know, individuals and teams are picking these things up. So we have to be confident those gaps are being filled. And the only way to find out is to have people focused on, you know, going through the detail, isn't it?
Yeah, and you're entirely right. Is that switch where the OFS was very clear that, you know, a lot of their relationship is with the board, the council, whatever you want to call them, and not really so much with the VC and the management structure, although some of them will be on council, etc. So, you know, realistically, the council can never dive into the level of assurance for absolutely everything. So still reliant on management and internal, external audit, consultants, reviews, whatever else it is. But there's a lot of work there that they are having to sign off at some point. So I guess like lots of other places, we've got relatively sounds terrible. We've got tight procedures around how data returns in particular are signed off and approved and go through, but also other mechanisms. So we've got and it's still relatively early light touch, but kind of a wider assurance framework to try and make sure we know who is doing what and where and when. And occasionally we do find new things where you're like, well, actually there's this, and sometimes it's down to the level of, you know, I can't keep a list centrally of every single academic professional body or something and be on top of all of it, but we need to know that that's being managed within the faculty, college, school, whatever structure you have. But it is increasingly complex.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I, you know, whether we like it or not, that is very much the direction of travel. Yeah. And, you know, we are obliged to respond to that, again, whether we like it or not. We can't just rely on historical patterns of professionalism and trust alone. No. Then they are not sufficient for our regulators and indeed for our governing body, which is, you know, obviously, you know, I personally find it a bit sad, but it's the world we are in. And, yeah, you know, in our roles, we've got to respond to that in order to address the kind of fundamental challenges and indeed risks the university faces. So developing that assurance framework seems to me to be absolutely elemental to enabling that.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been this obviously, and it's not, so there's been this like kind of a, you know, change to sometimes there are structures that we need to comply with or explain why we're doing something different. But over time, and one of my things I've raised periodically is that, you know, somebody else good or best practice becomes the accepted or therefore required practice for every institution. And for most institutions and most circumstances, that's probably okay. But there will be times where the fact that universities A, B, C, D, E, and F have all agreed to do this, it doesn't work for X, Y, and Z because they're much smaller, or they're much bigger, or you know, they're specialist, or the geography, whatever. And so there's a little bit of difficulty with that. I mean, and obviously it could all be up in the air if the OFS disappears in the next 6 months anyway, and we're more tightly regulated and in a different way. So we just I think we need to be fleet of foot. And you know, again, when we have consultations, whether from OFS or DfE or whoever, I think there's a little bit of an acceptance these days that the writing in some cases is very much on the wall, and we just need to work out how to deal with it rather than spend hours wringing our hands and whinging and complaining about it.
Yeah, it's picking your battles as well. And also there are, you know, there are some things which are, you know, in reality much more burdensome and troubling than others. And they tend to be, you know, great new ideas rather than necessarily things which are, you know, just different ways of doing the core activity where it's not really worth sweating over a lot of the detail, bearing in mind all the other challenges that we do face. Chris, can I take you back? So you mentioned your prior career in London before joining Hull. So, you know, and you talked about, you know, the aspiration to join a different kind of university, but how did you end up as a kind of university manager and administrator? Because I think you went that well-trodden route, I think, from a sabbatical officer, didn't you?
I did. So yeah, I did my both degree and PhD at Imperial in London, and then during that process I was very active in kind of sports clubs in particular, so kind of worked my way through different roles within sports clubs administration for Students' Union. And then when I finished my PhD, or when I was finishing it, I decided to apply to be a sabbatical. So I was Deputy President of Finance and Services, as the job title was at the time. So effectively, I was the person who did the work and said no to people, whereas somebody who's still my good friend was the president who stood up front, said yes, shook lots of hands, and then wandered off for us to pick up the pieces to some extent. Let's not spend ages about why I didn't move into chemistry, but I didn't move into chemistry, and I ended up playing computer games for 2 years as a job. So I worked for IDOS, who kind of made Tomb Raider and a whole load of other things. So I actually did quality assurance. I did testing for 2 years, which is as good and as bad as you can imagine. I think the way it sounds very nice and fun, but if I the way I express to people is, imagine somebody gives you a computer game which only has one level that takes 10 minutes to finish and is fundamentally broken, and that's all you've got to do for 2 weeks. It's not that much fun at times, but it is at times. Anyway, and then I decided I need to get a real job. And actually, it was my mum who saw this job advertised back at Imperial as assistant to the head of central secretariat. I thought it sounds quite good. It's a bit like administration. So I applied for that, and the three people interviewing were three people who were on the senior management team who I knew from when I'd been a sabbatical. So anyway, they employed me, and then I was there for about 5-6 years, and then I moved around. So I was in Imperial, as I said, and the registrar at the time, my academic registrar, told me, look, you need to get out, you're becoming institutionalized, you've been here student, and now you've worked here. And that there are lots of people who do that, but he said you just need to move on. And job came up at Kingston, which I thought was different, you know, still in London, but very different type of institution. And that's one of the things that I think is probably not just quirky to this sector, but in particular, is that people work at one institution sometimes for a long time and assume that's how every other university is. And whether it's the structures, as I said earlier, you know, structures, systems, processes, or whether it's the culture or whether it's the things they do, it's very different. And so, again, to the outside world, all universities are the same, but actually they are all individually unique for whatever reason. So I moved from a place which was, you know, super high research intensive to somewhere where they talked about things like widening participation and foundation degrees and collaborative partners in FE, which were all brand new concepts to me at the time. So yeah, I had a really nice time at Kingston. Then actually my boss moved from there to SOAS, and I followed him a year or so afterwards when there was a job. So I moved, worked there for 5 or 6 years. And I know you've interviewed a person from SAS before. SAS is a very quirky place, but amazing pros and also some quite challenging situations have to deal with. It's the only place I've had to hold my door shut while students have tried to knock it down with a fire extinguisher. And then Then I moved to London Met for a couple of years, and then moved up to Hull during COVID. So
fantastic. So I mean, it's a really, you know, interesting. I think your point about the diversity of institutions and their cultures, as exemplified by the distinctive nature of SOAS you articulated there. I don't think I've ever seen that, had that scenario myself before, but I have heard of similar other institutions, not many, but a few. Right. But I do think you're absolutely right on that. And that's what makes, you know, working in the sector so interesting, right? And working in different institutions in different roles, as you say, it can be, you know, chalk and cheese. It can be really, really different and diverse. And that's, you know, really exciting. But it also means that when you get that movement across institutions, you do get lots of new ideas and cross-fertilization, which is, I think, incredibly, you know, exciting and productive and good for institutions, because otherwise you just end up getting ossified and stale and, you know, nothing ever changes. So I think that's really exciting. So tell me about Hull then, right? Because Hull is, you know, is a very different kind of institution to all of those that you'd previously described. It has its, you know, its own long and proud history. You know, confession time, my daughter's just graduated from Hull, had a fantastic time there, and it was a wonderful degree ceremony, and I, you know, hugely enjoyed it. And I did love coming to Hull, and I really liked it. But because it's, I always think that because of its location, you know, getting people there must be a challenge. But my guess is that students and indeed staff, when they get there, love it. I mean, is that your kind of general perception of the place?
So yes, without a doubt. I mean, it is a great place, you know, and you're right. We're only a few years away from our centenary in 2027, so we're kind of gearing up towards that. I think that there is a little bit of a challenge with that kind of, it is the end of a train line, so that which is great in many ways and has lots of attractions, but it's not somewhere you necessarily pass through in general. But that said, people who go there, whether they're to study or to work, absolutely love the place, myself included, and that came through during the interview process, is how passionate people are about not just the university but what it does within in the local place. So, you know, our new strategy is kind of on the themes of people, place and partnership, and there really is a passion for the area, and we get that with students, with staff, with members of council, with local authority, with the NHS, etc., that we work with as well. That said, there are lots of, you know, struggles, local issues in terms of that, I hate using the phrase levelling up because it feels like I'm talking on behalf of government, but there are lots of issues in the local area that the university contributes towards. The university itself is amazing. It's a beautiful campus. I don't know if you made it up when you were there, because obviously degree ceremonies are most in the town centre. But it is a beautiful campus. It's got some really nice looking but also functioning buildings, and there's a lot of work going into the campus over the next few years as well, because we did an external private placement fundraising to do some work around that. But yeah, again, you know, it's a great student body. Some of the nicest sabbaticals I've had to work with in the last couple of years as well. So really enjoying it so far. It's a little bit strange, as you kind of, you know, and you remarked on it just before we were chatting, is today is the first day of our new vice chancellor, who starts today. So I've had one email from him so far today. So we'll see, how rapid those come in over the next few days. So
I'm sure there will be many more. But it's an interesting time, isn't it? And you know, because the transition between vice chancellors, you know, can be actually quite, you know, quite challenging for everyone concerned, not least the individual who's retiring or leaving, and the one who's taking over. But it also, I mean, there is a real sense of a new dawn as well, in that, you know, you've got a new person coming in, a new leader, right? You may have a university strategy in place already, and the direction of the university for years has been set. But nevertheless, there's a kind of real sense of excitement about what this person's going to bring, but also uncertainty about how you're going to get on with them, and how many emails they are going to send you. And my guess is you're feeling slightly reassured they have at least made contact, and that they know you're there.
No, you're right. And similarly, I guess, in the role of kind of registrar and secretary, we often get more involved in that kind of both the change, but also the transition from one to the next. And I think that was a really key point from our outgoing BC, it was very much around a transition rather than, you know, a clean break. I'm off day X and someone say Ryan day Y. So I think they have quite a lot of interaction in advance so that there's a very smooth transition from one to the next. But you're right, it is a new, it's a catalyst, it's a new point for us to look at what we're doing. I think over the last 4 or 5 years, the university has had to make quite a lot of tough decisions, particularly financial. The university took over £20 million out of its cost base over a 2.5-3 year period. And if it hadn't have done that, it could have been a very different story from where we are now. But we're on a really good footing now financially. Well, as much as anybody was until the last 6 months or so happened.
Yeah.
I'll come back to that again as well if you want to, in terms of where we are. But there's still more work to do. And it's a relatively new team. So I started February 21, but the chief people officer, so HR director, and the COO have started more recently than I am. Obviously, we've got a new VC. Most of the other senior team appointments were within the last 4 or 5 years. It's still a relatively new team, but equally, that and this is my perception, they may not all agree with me, is that partly because of COVID, we've not necessarily had as many interactions face to face as other people would in that period. So there's still quite a good piece of work there for the new VC to come in terms of team building, development, as well as all the other things that we need to do in terms of systems, processes, looking at structures, you know, future academic direction, teaching, research, student mix, all the other big issues that everybody's having to deal with.
I think that will be both, you know, exciting and probably a little bit scary at times as well, as people are kind of testing each other out. But there is a real opportunity, I think, for a new VC having got that, as you say, relatively new team to actually to put their stamp on it and indeed lead the institution in a particular direction. I want to go back to a point you mentioned earlier. I mean, you reluctantly use the term leveling up, but I think it's lost all meaning, right? But the point about it is, I think, is that the role that universities play, not just in their communities, but as in their local economies, is, you know, has grown in significance over the past 20 years, I think. And I mean, one of the things that struck me about, you know, visiting Hull on a number of occasions is it genuinely felt like the university was, you know, an, if not the anchor institution in the city, right? You know, in the, you know, it's a city with a kind of proud heritage and then the kind of maritime history and all the rest of it, right? But a lot of that has, you know, there's bits of it left, obviously, but a lot of it is no longer there because it's in the past. But the university is very much of now and of the future as well. And it did seem to me that that was kind of a really powerful sense you got of it playing a critical role in the city and the region.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest anchors and angles for us and the local economy, community, society, the rest of it is linked to that kind of carbon neutrality, sustainability agenda. So, the Humber region is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, kind of carbon outputters in the country and has got this aim to be net zero, which we're part of. But equally, it's not just that. It's also the looking forward and, you know, the kind of future technologies, recyclables, renewables, whatever else it is. And it's always... It was one of the most amazing things when I first started is I was staying in the University Halls of Residence at the time because obviously there were very few students on campus. And so they got flats there and they were on the top floor. And so every other week at the time, and you'd look out the window and you'd just see these kind of wind, and people can't see my hand, it's audio, but you see these wind turbines kind of moving up week by week, and then they'd all just disappear. And then 2 weeks later, there'd be another set being built and they're just churning them out. Pushing them out. And I know people have views on wind versus solar versus whatever, but offshore wind is, you know, we're one of the biggest producers in the world of that. And it's amazing to watch how fast some of this is done. So yeah, the university's role in that, not just as an employer and therefore big contributor and all the rest, it's very much into those kind of interactions with our local partners, both the local authority, but also then through into the local businesses, etc. And we're trying to do more work in that area. I think it's a big kind of a linchpin, big part of the strategy that, as you said, you know, any new VC, any new leader coming in will be able to put their own direction spin on as well. So
that's fantastic to hear. And kind of building out of that, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the kind of financial challenges universities have faced, but there is a kind of different financial challenge, I think, which is going to hit us, or is already hitting us, in terms of, you know, the spiraling cost of energy, which are just going to be absolutely, you know, just extraordinary in their impact on institutions as well as wider society, right? But the impact of, you know, the kind of cost of living, not just energy prices, on our students, and indeed on some of our, you know, particularly our lower paid staff, is going to be, that's going to be really difficult to deal with. And it feels to me that we're all institutions, and indeed all organizations and companies, will be really starting to grapple with this right now, because there's kind of, obviously there's been a hiatus at the heart of government with the leadership contest and all. So, you know, we've all kind of been trying to find answers ourselves. So have you begun to think about this in Hull, or what's your own personal thoughts on how it'll pan out for universities?
Yeah. So in some ways it's a mirror to what we're all going to end up facing in our own lives. That's just, I think quite a lot of the population, and some of us in some ways have kind of, it's not quite the ostrich head in the sand, but we've kind of not been necessarily worrying about it perhaps as much as it might be the cost of living. You know, I think the numbers you see for energy prices for us as individuals are pretty terrifying. But when you work that up to organizational levels, you can see how we're now starting to see these reports about, you know, the number of pubs, businesses, whatever, that just won't be able to afford it. And you know, the fact that this is going to be a, not necessarily, well, it may be in terms of life, but in terms of impact, potentially even bigger than COVID in terms of what it is, whether universities and big organizations like that, which kind of, again, somewhat straddle the divide between public and private institutions, will get the same level of protection as perhaps we might see for individuals or small businesses, remains to be seen. But yeah, I mean, I think our energy bill in the year just finished was about $3.5 million. And it's significantly more than that on our current projections for this year. So pushing, it's not commercially in confidence because it'll end up somewhere. It's probably pushing up towards 20 million, if not more. So if you look at that order of increase, and our annual budget last year, or income is 195 or something, so you're suddenly spending 10% of your income on energy costs. It's not easy.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. So in answer to your direct answer to your question, yes, we are looking at it. So we've set up effectively a rapid action group to look at what we can do, both in terms of faster decarbonisation, faster move to alternative fuels for ourselves. And that was already in our plan because of the private placement we took out, was to do things like solar farms and move to ground source heat pumps and whatever else it was, as part of our pledge to be carbon neutral on campus by end of 26. So we're trying to accelerate that. But obviously then there are issues around procurement, delivery of components, planning, all the rest of it. You can't just do it overnight. But also what we can do both around estates and facilities on campus, working practices, all the other things that might reduce our costs, but also make it easier for staff and students as well. Because you're right, some of those will start to bite. And we started to see, you know, things like, well, or go into work more often, or all go to the library, but the library may not have the electricity and power on as much as you're hoping. And if your workplace, wherever that might, if it's Jacob Rees-Mogg, then he shut your building for 3 days a week and sold it off because he thought you weren't there anyway. So you can no longer go into it to keep warm. And I know that's slightly flippant, but I think as hubs for many of students, and particularly our students who will have financial issues, and if, was the other day, you know, the number one thing people are searching for now in rentals are bills included.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to be subject to those fluctuations. And the rental market in Hull is quite buoyant in some ways, but at the same time, the prices are not going to be cheap for people because, and you know, it's been an issue for the sector for a while. There's a big difference between fees and student loans versus actual, the fact you need to live and probably work around that to be able to afford to study. So.
Yeah. One final question, Chris. And this is slightly silly, but I mean, you referred to students trying to batter down your door earlier. But you've been worked in higher education a long time. What's the strangest thing you've ever come across anywhere in higher education, or the thing that's perplexed you or surprised you the most?
So I guess a couple of things. So the strangest probably was the the passion of the students at SOAS, particularly to whatever their particular angle on social injustice, predominantly rather than social justice, and, you know, a slight fixation on issues in the Middle East. So let's use the generic term. Because I've always been a scientist, I've never really mentally been engaged in that thought space. So for me, that was quite difficult to understand that. And I would have conversations with people where I would say to them, so, you know, you're saying we should be doing this because that's better for the world or whatever else it is. But if I presented you with all the evidence about this and told you that this is what we should be doing because this is it, and categorically you could not argue with it, would you agree? And they'd go, no, because my principles are the other way. And I was like, ah. And for me, that was just a really weird thing, as coming from a very analytical science background, suddenly run into this kind of very principled driven. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but for me, it was just unusual. I think the thing that struck me and continues to strike me as perhaps one of the biggest challenges for us, and we touched on it earlier, is the sector's ability to absorb new ideas and kind of reinvent and change itself. And we seem to, as you said, we kind of seem to be reasonable about doing that where people come in or move around the sector and say, well, this is what I've done elsewhere, we're going to do it, and that seems to be reasonably well done. But I've seen lots of people come in now from outside of the sector, and I've worked with a couple of colleagues at the moment, and they've come in and it's not just the why the hell are you doing it this way, or we've always done it that way, but sometimes there's not even a rationale. I can't even say what, it's not that we've always done it that way, it's just I don't know, yeah, what you're telling me makes perfect sense, and I don't have any explanation why we wouldn't consider doing it that way. I can see why sometimes, you know, you sometimes get these switches in senior teams where they appoint people from outside the sector who come in with these great ideas, but perhaps don't necessarily get the bite and the traction to do some things that would perhaps change the nature. And I'll come back to a comment on that in a second. And then it flips back to the other way. But I just remember it's like... So when I was at Imperial, Richard Sykes was the rector, and he'd obviously come in from GlaxoSmithKline, very different thing. And he just said this one thing to me at the time, didn't really take home, but's kind of stuck with me a lot since, which is he kind of, and I'm not getting his phrasing quite right or his accent, but he kind of said, you know, is that, yeah, we are providing education, but we're a business. We're in the business of delivering education. You can't accept that you're living in this kind of like holy cow environment where nobody's going to do things to you. If you want to change and become better, there are things from business you have to accept, and I still don't think we're necessarily very good at doing that.
I would agree. I think we're highly selective at best in that, and there is just this, you know, deep-rooted skepticism about the, you know, large parts of the world outside the university, yeah. And particularly anything that might be commercial or commercially minded. And, you know, you just need to hear the, you know, the sharp intake breath of if anyone refers to a student as a customer, right? In any context.
and that's actually probably one of the best examples is the mindset of trying to view student recruitment as a marketing, recruitment, replacement, retention, and you could use some horrible words that people wouldn't like, activity, versus the, well, we're an academic institution, we've got amazing degrees, why would they not want to come here in the numbers that somebody put down on a piece of paper 2 years ago? Yeah. Because the world's changed. Other people in the sector, and I'm sure you're a great exemplar of this, have changed their approach, and not every institution has.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You've got to behave in different ways in different domains of university life. Yeah. And just because you're competing in a market for students doesn't mean that the fundamentals around your teaching and research are compromised by that.
Yeah.
Right. It is possible to do both.
Yeah, yeah.
And live with that dissonance.
Yeah. And equally, you know, we need to be mature enough to accept that the people we're really hard competing with students for whatever reason on here are the same people we want to collaborate really strongly with on research innovation over here. And there is a tension. I remember when it was still Hefke, they talked about kind of, you know, the balance between collaboration and competition, but it's different for different spheres, as you said. So
absolutely. Well, for younger listeners, Hefke disappeared a few years ago, but I'm sure many fondly remember it. Chris, we need to stop there, but listen, thank you ever so much for your time and for the conversation. I've hugely enjoyed that. Thank you.
I'll see you soon.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.